Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as I said before the news, in the turmoil of this Arab Spring, all roads seem to lead to Saudi Arabia. In today's headlines alone, Yemen's embattled president agrees to talk with other Gulf states, where? In Saudi Arabia, about possibly resigning, while Iran demands that Saudi troops leave Bahrain, where they are helping to quell that country's uprising. And Defense Secretary Robert Gates has arrived in the Saudi capital to try and mend fences with King Abdullah, who refused to even meet with him and Hillary Clinton last time around. At that time, he said he was sick and canceled, but a lot of people don't believe that he was really ill. They think he was more ticked off. So let's talk about this trip by Secretary Gates and other ways that all roads seem to lead to Saudi Arabia right now. Joining me now is Carol Murphy, correspondent for Global Post and the Christian Science Monitor, and author of Passion for Islam, Shaping the Modern Middle East, The Egyptian Experience. Carol, welcome to WNYC. Are you in Riyadh today?
Oh, hi, Brian. Yes, I am. And we're having a big dust storm.
A big dust storm. Well, it's not affecting phone reception. You sound more clear than most people we talk to in Brooklyn, so that's good. It's widely known that relations between King Abdullah and the Obama administration are not particularly warm right now. Why is Gates there?
Well, he's here to repair what has been a potentially very dangerous disagreement between the United States and Saudi Arabia. And this began back when Hosni Mubarak stepped down. The Saudis were really appalled at Obama's decision in the end to side with the Egyptian demonstrators and demand that Mubarak leave office. The Saudis saw this as a great betrayal of a longtime ally and friend. Then on top of that came the situation in Bahrain. Now, the United States was working very hard to get the ruling royal family in Bahrain to sit down and dialogue with the moderate opposition there. And Saudi Arabia didn't really like that idea, because any dialogue would have brought up the idea of a constitutional monarchy. This is what the Bahraini opposition was hoping to talk about. Mm-hmm. And the Saudis don't like that idea, because it would mean the possibility that the idea would migrate over to them, because they don't have a constitutional monarchy. They have an absolute monarchy. So there was a great deal of perturbation in Riyadh over Obama's actions in Egypt, and then the way the U.S. didn't really buy the Saudi view of what was going on in Bahrain. And then it came to a head over Libya. The Americans wanted the Saudi support for the no-fly zone, but the Saudis dug in their heels and said, well, if you're going to criticize us for sending troops in to support the ruling family in Bahrain, we're not going to support the no-fly zone. So there was an understanding that the United States wouldn't criticize the Saudi military in Bahrain too much. So I think that Gates is here because, as you said, he was refused a visit a month ago, and I think he's here to get the relationship back on an even keel.
Listeners, if you have any questions or thoughts about Saudi Arabia or these other situations in the Middle East that somehow relate to Saudi Arabia, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. For Carol Murphy, correspondent for Global Post and the Christian Science Monitor in Riyadh, and author of Passion for Islam, Shaping the Modern Middle East, The Egyptian Experience, 212-433-9692, or you can post to our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Carol, all around Saudi Arabia, there's political instability. You mentioned Bahrain, of course. There's Yemen to the south, Egypt just across the Red Sea, Jordan to the north having protests. There have been protests in Saudi Arabia, but not on the same scale. What makes that country different? I mean, it really hasn't come to Saudi Arabia like almost every other country in the region.
Yeah, you're right there. And there's lots of reasons for that. Last March 11th, some people on Facebook had called for a day of rage in Saudi Arabia. And nothing happened. Nobody came out to protest. And there were several reasons for that. First of all, there was a big police presence on the streets. Secondly, people here weren't sure of who these people on Facebook were who were calling for this protest. But, you know, the really big reason is that the Saudi Arabian population is very, very conservative, both religiously and politically. They have no tradition of street protests. And they really do listen to their religious leaders, sort of like Catholics did 80 years ago. And the religious leaders were telling them, you know, it's not religiously okay to demonstrate in the streets. In fact, there was an official fatwa saying that. Now, another reason there were no big protests is that it is very true that there is a growing slice of Saudis here who do want more political participation. They want political reform. They sometimes talk about a constitutional monarchy. They want an end to corruption. But this is a very small slice of the population right now. It is growing, but it's still very small. And, you know, a final reason is that 10 days before March 11th, before the so-called Day of Rage, King Abdullah, who is very much liked here, announced a huge financial package, giving everybody, financial benefit. Saudi Arabia is a wealthy country, and while the citizens don't really share in deciding how the money is used, they do get some of that money.
So he's not exactly Paul Ryan when it comes to domestic spending. You don't have to get that. That's okay. Andrew in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I'm very interested why your guest failed to mention the Iranian role in all of this. It seems rather obvious that the reason the Saudis are so apoplectic with us is that we fail to recognize the Iranian role in the events that are spreading across the Middle East, particularly in Bahrain. Bahrain is a majority Shia country, and Iran has a relatively small but centrally located Shia minority, and the Saudis believe that Iran is behind the protests in Bahrain and see it as part of a larger competition between Iran and the West in the area. And I'm surprised that your guest didn't even mention that.
Carol, what about Iran?
Well, I haven't mentioned it because I was talking about other things, but there's no doubt about it that Iran is the big elephant in the room. And I'm sure that's going to be on the agenda between Gates and King Abdullah and other Saudi officials here today. The Saudis do see Iran as interfering in Arab affairs. They see Iran as very bellicose, and they are deeply concerned that Iran will take advantage of the discontent in Bahrain. However, that being said, U.S. officials and other observers, and I just came back from a week in Bahrain, don't see that the opposition in Bahrain or the protest movement there that started last February was started or instigated by Iran. Certainly, Iran is making political hay about the fact that the Saudis put troops into Bahrain, but the opposition there does have legitimate political grievances, and this is the argument of the United States. You've got to address these grievances in order to reduce the discontent.
I want to turn now to Yemen, and Andrew, thank you for your call. Yemen is Saudi Arabia's neighbor to the south. The protesters there are demanding the resignation of President Ali Abdullah Saleh, but that has serious implications for global counterterrorism efforts. There's a strong al-Qaeda presence in Yemen. They're known to be behind a few of the recent incidents in the United States. It's been reported that the government is recalling troops from around the country, including more al-Qaeda populated areas, to prop up the government troops typically used to fight terrorism. Now, the Obama administration has had to adapt to the developments in Yemen, and I want to play two contrasting clips. First, from Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. This was on This Week with Christiane Amanpour 2 weeks ago.
The most active and at this point, perhaps the most aggressive branch of al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula operates out of Yemen. And we have had a lot of counterterrorism cooperation from President Saleh and the Yemeni security services. So if that government collapses or is replaced by one that is dramatically more weak, then I think we'll face some additional challenges out of Yemen. There's no question about it. It's a real problem.
So Gates seemed to be leaning towards stability in Yemen as in the U.S. interest, but that was March 27th. Here is White House spokesman Jay Carney on Monday.
We are obviously concerned that in this period of political unrest, that al-Qaeda and other groups will attempt to take advantage of that power vacuum, and that's one of the reasons why we urge political dialogue to take place and a timetable for this transition that President Saleh has talked about to be begun.
So suddenly we're talking about transition, and Carol, it seems like the line of the Obama White House now really is that Saleh, longtime U.S. ally, despite, you know, being in power for decades and decades and becoming very unpopular in his country, suddenly the White House position is Saleh has to go. What do you understand about the possible transition that Carney mentioned? And I gather these talks now may take place in Saudi Arabia, too.
Well, the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is an organization that is Saudi Arabia and five other Gulf countries, offered on Sunday to be a mediator between the opposition and Saleh. Saleh's accepted that. The opposition has said so far, we just want him to go, and then we'll talk about the future. So they really haven't accepted that offer. I know there are intense efforts right now by Saudi Arabia to try to resolve the situation. They also supported Saleh, like the United States did, for a long time because he was seen as, you know, the best option available. But, you know, in these last couple of weeks where Saleh's allowed men to go on rooftops and just take pot shots at people in the street, one day killing over 50 people in one day, there's no longer any stability in Yemen. The stability's gone, even with him in power. So I think both the Saudis and the United States agree that, you know, he's got to go. But their dilemma is who comes after him. And I'm telling you, Yemen's a real mess economically and politically. It's a real big problem for both countries.
We saw the Arab states and the Gulf states get together and demand the ouster of, or at least the no-fly zone in Libya with Muammar Gaddafi. Are people going to come together now, meaning the leaders in the region, to help with the transition out of power for Saleh in Yemen?
I don't know if they'll do the same as they did in Libya, just for the main fact that Gaddafi has fewer friends among Arab leaders than Saleh does. But definitely, I think the Gulf countries and the GCC and Saudi Arabia are going to come together and try behind the scenes to, you know, convince Saleh to step down and then try to convince the opposition to come up with some kind of plan for running the country.
Carol Murphy, correspondent for Global Post and the Christian Science Monitor and author of Passion for Islam, Shaping the Modern Middle East, The Egyptian Experience, and she's in Riyadh today. Nigar in Douglaston, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Good morning. Good morning.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I'm listening with great interest to your program and your guest, who seems to have an insight into what's really happening there. And having lived in that part of the world for 10 years myself, I feel it's very exciting to see that an American administration is actually supporting the forces of change and of democracy in that part of the world. I mean, there was stability. These repressive regimes were supported by the United States for decades. But even 15 years ago when I lived there, you could see that, you know, the people, there was frustrations, economic, it was really bad, and it's very exciting to see the changes. And I just want to say that naturally Saudi Arabia is going to be very nervous because of the changes happening in their neighborhood. But I think nothing can stop this wave of change now that it's started.
Nigar, thank you very much. Let me read another comment about Iran from our website, Carol. This relates to what Nigar was just saying, but puts it in an even bigger historical perspective and possible future perspective. Jagar Buzz from Queens writes, "We tied the fate of the U.S. economy to the fate of the House of Saud back in 1944 when FDR agreed that the U.S. would be the protector of the House of Saud in exchange for oil, U.S. oil company dominance in the peninsula, and relatively cheap oil. Suburbia was built on cheap oil. As the House of Saud goes, so goes suburban America. Iran is just waiting to take over Mecca and double oil prices to bring America to its knees before it." How much of that do you agree with?
I think there may be some extremists in the Revolutionary Guards in Iran that are just waiting to take over Mecca, but I don't think most reasonable politicians in Tehran, and there are some, would think that that's a likely proposition. Let's face it, Iran is in a terrible economic mess itself, and the price of oil going up benefits them, and yes, they are very belligerent. Yes, they don't like the Saudi Arabia, but I have to say, in the last few days, I've been impressed by how the Iranians are accusing the Gulf countries of acting at America's behest, and why don't we just sit down and be friends? I mean, that's the gist of the remarks coming out of Tehran the last couple of days, which I find surprising. To me, it says that they're pretty nervous, too. They're pretty nervous about the fact that Saudi Arabia is getting a huge arms package from the United States, which is going to include probably an upgrade in their own missile defenses against Iranian missiles. So, you know, Iran has its own concerns, and it is belligerent, and it has to learn to live with its neighbors. But, you know, it's not something that's imminent and that war is going to break out.
We're going to be out of time in just a minute. But your book is Islam Shaping the Modern Middle East, The Egyptian Experience. What's your quick take on the evolving role of Islam in the new politics of Egypt? It's one of the big questions that people in this country keep asking with respect to the new Egypt and the role of the Muslim Brotherhood. What do you see?
I think this is one of the most interesting aspects that's going to be watched in the post, Tahrir Square days. I think that you're going to see the Muslim Brotherhood really make some electoral gains in the next election. I don't think it's going to be 80 or 90% and that they're going to take over and run the government. I think that the secular forces there, especially the young people who ran the protest in the square, they're going to also be a big voice. So, you know, there's going to be an interesting dialogue now that the people have more freedom to express themselves, and now that the Muslim Brotherhood is no longer an illegal organization. There's going to be a lot of discussion in Egypt. What does it mean to be a Muslim state? What does it mean to be an Islamic state? What is the relationship between Islam and the state? So this dialogue between the secular forces and the Islamist forces, I think, is going to be very intense in Egypt. And that's all to the good, because these questions have been shoved under the rug for too long.
Well, Islamist states are very different in Pakistan and Turkey and Saudi Arabia. We'll see what it develops into in Egypt to the extent that it develops into that at all. Carol Murphy from Global Post and the Christian Science Monitor and author of Passion for Islam, thank you so much for coming on with us.
It's my pleasure, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Arizona considers a $50 fee for Medicaid patients who smoke or are obese and don't lose weight. Good idea. Should we go down that road in general of charging people extra for their behaviors to pay into the healthcare system? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. Are you aghast by this? Are you encouraged by this? 212-433-9692, and we'll get a reporter's details on what it's all about and take your calls in a minute.